I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 25th of April, and a beauty of a day it is here in Milwaukee. All things political coming up this hour, and our guest is Avik Roy. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He has an interesting background. He's the opinion editor at Forbes. He has advised Florida Senator Marco Rubio on policy, was a senior advisor to former Texas Governor Rick Perry. He served as a health care policy advisor to Mitt Romney. He is the principal author of The Apothecary. It's a blog on healthcare policy and entitlement reform. And he's the author of Transcending Obamacare, a patient-centered plan for near universal coverage and permanent fiscal solvency. We have a lot to talk about. We'll start on the Republican side. As you heard during the news from National Public Radio, Senator Ted Cruz and Governor John Kasich have agreed to coordinate in future primary contests in an attempt to deny Donald Trump the Republican presidential nomination, giving Cruz a clear path in Indiana, and Kasich is going to be competing in Oregon and also in New Mexico. We will talk about that. We'll look at the number of delegates that Trump has right now, and I didn't know this, but 200 delegates will arrive as free agents if he is close to 1,237. Are those 200 likely to announce for Trump right before the convention and make sure that he gets the convention, or is it bound to be contested? We've been talking about that for some time. We will continue talking about that. We'll look at the Democratic race as well, where it would appear that Hillary Clinton is going to get the nomination. And there's been a lot of writing lately about whether or not Bernie Sanders should give up his fight, should not give up his fight, what he's done to energize young people, and made the party look at lots of different issues: minimum wage, wealth inequality, college tuition, globalization. His reliance on small donors has been quite something. And there has been some conversation about whether or not she needs to become more moderate in order to appeal to more moderate voters, or does she need to make concessions to Bernie Sanders to win his supporters and unite the party. Just a few of the things I thought we ought to discuss this hour, but feel free to take it all on wherever you'd like to go as we talk all things political, and here's how you talk about it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Avik Roy, nice to have you with us again. Hi.
Hey.
Hi.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Why don't we start? I know this is happening on the Democratic side, but there was an interesting piece in the New York Times yesterday by a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center who served a couple Republican administrations. He wrote, "Friendship in the Age of Trump. The candidacy of Donald J. Trump is not only fracturing the Republican Party, it's breaking up friendships as well. A prominent Republican," he writes, describing a Trump-related disagreement with another influential Republican with whom he's been close for decades, "sent me a note that stated things in a matter-of-fact way. We had a friendship-ending email exchange." Is there a lot of that going on the Republican side? I know there's some of it on the Democratic side as well.
You know, it's funny, I was up in at a birthday party for a college friend a couple weeks ago in Boston, and at the after party, the birthday party, I was talking to another one of my college friends, one of my best friends from college. I've known him for 20 years, and I was expressing my view that a part of the appeal of Trump is due to racists who are against immigrants coming to this country. And he was so profoundly offended that I said that he didn't talk to me for weeks, and I found out from his wife that, you know, Avik thinks that you've ended your friendship with him over. He was so offended and hurt that you said that, and I was like, "Wow!" So I had to make up with him the other night and call him up and see if we could repair things. So yeah, it's happening, and if he's the nominee, this is not going to just be here and there. It's going to be all over America.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be. Why do you think Donald Trump wants to be president? Has anybody asked him that?
You know, I take him at his word that he believes that he would be good at it. You know, there have been anecdotal reports that he ran. There have been some insiders who've left the Trump camp who said that he ran not because he thought he believed he could win, but because he would do a strong second and then use that as a branding opportunity for his other endeavors.
Right.
But obviously, he underestimated his own appeal, it turns out, and he's doing very well. And if you're in that position, why wouldn't you want to be president, I suppose?
Right. So what do you think of this? I don't know, it seems late in the game, but this strategy by Cruz and Kasich to give Cruz Indiana, to give Kasich Oregon and New Mexico, is it a good strategy, and why did they wait so long?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's particularly, it's interesting because there was a similar situation like this about a month ago when Marco Rubio was arguing that Kasich and Cruz should stay out of Florida, that Rubio and Cruz should stay out of Ohio, et cetera, on that one, you know, that big day in Super Tuesday. And everyone refused to do that except Rubio. So Rubio didn't compete in Ohio, but he did compete in Florida. It didn't work out for Rubio so well. He ended up dropping out. But this time around, it looks like Cruz and Kasich have determined that their interests are aligned in this case, and we'll see how it goes. I mean, it did seem to have an impact a month ago when the Super Tuesday things were happening, the strategic voting that Mitt Romney actually initially called for. You know, it had an effect, and voters are tend to be well informed enough to say, you know what, I'm not going to throw away my vote on somebody who doesn't have a chance of winning. So we'll see.
Yeah, you know, tomorrow we have a lot of primaries, five primaries. Where does everybody stand at this point? Will Trump do well in Pennsylvania, other states that he'll do well, or does he stand a chance of losing some of those?
Well, he's definitely leading in most of those Acela corridor states. The one big wild card is Pennsylvania, and I don't know if you've mentioned this to your listeners, but the odd thing about Pennsylvania is Pennsylvania is, of course, a big state with 71 delegates, which is a large number, but most of those delegates are unbound, meaning that only a small fraction, a minority of the delegates are assigned based on the vote, the outcome of the vote in Pennsylvania. The rest can go to the convention and vote their conscience. And so the big question is, are those unbound delegates going to vote for Trump, or are they going to vote for someone like Ted Cruz? And a lot of that will depend on who the delegates actually are, who are the actual individuals that Pennsylvania sends to Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me as though Trump is getting pretty darn close. The figures I have, tell me if you have different figures. Trump has 845 delegates, Cruz 559, Kasich only has 148. Trump is pretty close to that 1,237, isn't he?
Yeah, the way my little spreadsheet works it out is if things go according to the way the polls are now, Trump will be at somewhere around 1,178. Now, that's, again, it depends on a number of factors. It depends on, can Trump outperform in certain states relative to where he is now? And the biggest swing possibility is California. So right now I have Trump gaining about 93 delegates in California of the 172 that California awards. If Trump is able to do very, very well in California, and it looks like he may, there are some recent polls out that suggest that Trump is going to do as well in California as he did in New York. If that's true, Trump will get very, very close to that 1253 threshold. So we'll see. I'd call it sort of, let's call it 55-45 right now. 55% chance that Trump gets to 1237, 45% chance he doesn't. And if he doesn't, it's much more likely that Cruz ends up winning on the second ballot.
Really? You think that would happen? What, people are going to be darn mad, aren't they? Those who are Trump supporters?
People are going to be mad either way, right? So if Trump is the nominee, then the people who don't like Trump are going to be mad. And if Trump isn't the nominee, the people who do like Trump are going to be mad. And I would say of those two outcomes, the latter one is a little bit more favorable to Republicans insofar as a lot of the people who are voting for Trump are people who haven't voted historically in the past. They're new voters.
Right.
You know, so in terms of if you think about a general election dynamic, if you have voters who haven't voted before and they don't vote in this election, it has less of an impact on the general election dynamic.
So how did this happen? How did Donald Trump become the presumptive favorite of the Republican Party right now?
Well, there are going to be probably 100 or 200 or 1,000 graduate students in political science departments all around America who are going to get tenure because they write theses about this, right? You know, there's a lot of things to talk about here. I'd say that a couple that are worth focusing on are, one, that nationalism as a worldview is a very common impulse in democratic countries. We see it all over Europe, mm-hmm. This idea of, you know, in the U.S. we have this unique thing where economic nationalism, that is being against free trade, being against corporations leaving the country, things like that, that's been very much a democratic province, and then Republicans have cared more about, shall we call it, cultural nationalism. But in Europe, cultural nationalism and economic nationalism are often found in the same party. And so what Trump is hitting on and what Ross Perot before him and Pat Buchanan and some others have hit on, is this idea that both forms of nationalism, economic nationalism and cultural nationalism, go together. And so in that sense, there is a natural constituency for that worldview. So there's that aspect of it. And the other aspect of it is that Trump has not been as chaotic and impulsive as everybody thinks. He certainly comes across that way, but what a lot of people don't realize is that Trump has been planning to run for president for a very long time. And he has spent with his inner circle the last 4, 5, 6 years listening to talk radio every day.
Really?
To get a really good sense of what that base voter, what that average common person thinks about politics. And he's really tapped into that feeling out there that the elites in both parties have not been attending to the concerns of average Americans.
Mm. But a lot of that talk radio, witness what happened in Wisconsin, doesn't like Trump very much.
Well, Wisconsin is a special case, and it was obviously a very interesting case, because you've had in Wisconsin this hyper-politicized situation over the last 5, 6 years, and as a result of that, the Trump phenomenon couldn't really the ground had already been plowed and gardened by the Democrats and Republicans, the more traditional Democrats and Republicans. There wasn't really any room for Trump. And the real test of whether what happened in Wisconsin translates to other states is going to be in Indiana, which is voting on the 3rd of May. If Wisconsin is replicable in other states, then Cruz should do well in Indiana. But I suspect that a big part of what made Wisconsin go the way it did is because the Republican voters in Wisconsin have been voting for Scott Walker, have been voting for the Republican legislators for some time now, and they have a good relationship with those legislators. And talk radio in Wisconsin mm-hmm. is very aligned with those individuals.
And those are organized voters. Those voters are turning out.
That's right. That's right. So that to me is a bit of a different situation in Wisconsin. But we'll see. I think again, Indiana will be an interesting test case to see that's part of what this whole going back to your original question, the Kasich-Cruz alliance here. Part of that was to say, you know, Kasich will concede Cruz to Indiana to Cruz, which from a regional standpoint, you think because Kasich's the Midwesterner, he'd want to fight in Indiana. But I think they both seem to understand that Cruz is the guy who has the shot at denying Donald Trump the victory there.
Mm-hmm.
And if he does, that would be a big deal. That would be a big development in this race.
So after, I don't know what's going to happen in November, who the heck knows at this point, but I would imagine that, you know, I keep trying to understand what the Republican Party was doing when Mitt Romney lost, and there was all this soul-searching about having to expand, having to do as George W. Bush did and reach out to Latino voters, and the Republican Party simply had to do that. What's amazing to me is that quite the opposite has happened, Avik, and it looks as though the party itself is just kind of disintegrating, and I'm wondering what in the world do the Republicans do now?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. There were a lot of people, as you say, who after the Romney loss said, we've got to do more to appeal to people who aren't voting Republican, whether that means minorities, whether that means younger voters, whether it just means just people who, you know, blue-collar whites, whoever it is. There's lots of people out there who are dissatisfied with what Republicans are doing. We got to reach out to them. We got to appeal to them. That was what you heard a lot of people say after 2012. However, there was another group of people, of which Ted Cruz in particular was a leading voice, who argued the exact opposite, made the exact opposite argument. They said, the problem is we've been nominating these moderates like Mitt Romney and John McCain and Bob Dole, and we keep losing because the enthusiastic grassroots voters are staying home. And what we need to do is not move to the center. We have to move to the right to activate those voters and be more polarizing, which, you know, I'm in the former camp rather than the latter camp, but Cruz, at least in the nomination process, has been proven more correct.
I thought for sure, and you have been a policy advisor to Senator Marco Rubio, I really thought that he would be the strongest candidate. I'm not sure he performed all that well in debates, but do you think still that he would have been? And what happened to that campaign that had so much promise?
Yeah, I mean, I still believe that Marco Rubio would have been the strongest, would be and was then the strongest general election candidate, and that was an opinion shared by most Democrats I know at the highest levels. Everyone understood that, and that was what was so surprising, is that one of the things that's unique about this year, usually in primaries, pollsters will ask a question. They'll say, what's more important to you in a nominee for your party? Is it A, that the nominee or the candidate shares your values, or B, is it that the candidate will do the best job of beating the other party in the general election?
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, most election years, two-thirds of people will say B. Two-thirds of people say, you know what, I'd ideally like to have someone who shares my values completely, but what's more important to me is that the candidate win the election. And what you see in actually both parties this year is the opposite. It's flipped. If you ask Republican voters that question, primary voters that question, let's say two-thirds of them care about the person should appeal to me, like, you know, share my values, and only a third say I care about whether the person wins the election. And on the Democratic side, you're seeing a lot of that sentiment as well, which is why Bernie Sanders is doing so well. So I don't know what's in the water these days, but that has been a significant change that people feel so frustrated by the people that have been elected to office or winning these nominations that haven't been getting it done, that in both parties there's profound dissatisfaction with that more traditional approach.
Right. One more question from me, and then we'll go to our phone calls. A lot has been said about this, but I'm interested in your take on it. You're a smart guy. The Wall Street Journal NBC News poll showing 56% of Americans view Hillary Clinton unfavorably, 32% favorably, Trump even more disliked. Gallup showing that his unfavorability was, 64%, and his favorable is 32%. And Gallup also showing that both candidates are more unpopular than the losing presidential candidate at any point during the last five election cycles. That's amazing to me.
It's remarkable, it's one of these things that people will be studying for a long time, because it's not normally how voters behave.
Right.
And the only thing there are a couple of things you can think of. I mean, a lot of people, probably people you've had on your show, talk about the heightened political polarization in the new digital media era. So that may be playing some part in it. Fox News and MSNBC really distilling the most active and antagonistic voters against each other. But I do think that part of it is that the economy has struggled so much in the last 7 or 8 years since the financial crisis. We have statistically had job growth, but people just do not feel it. Most of the economic gains on the Obama presidency have gone to the top 1%. And I think a lot of people just feel the system isn't working for them, and there's just profound pessimism out there. And people are lashing out because they don't see anyone that they really believe is going to solve the problems. They just figured, let me just make a protest vote.
Yeah. Well, let's go to phone calls for you. We've mostly concentrated on the Republican side, but Avik Roy is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and has done a lot of work with Republicans. He was a senior advisor to former Texas Governor Rick Perry. He has advised Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who you heard him say he thought would be the strongest candidate for the Republicans to nominate. He is the opinion editor at Forbes. He served as a health care policy, this is really his special area, advisor to Mitt Romney. He's the founder of Roy Healthcare Research, and he was an analyst and portfolio manager at Bain and J.P. Morgan as well. He's the author of a very important book on health care, Transcending Obamacare, A Patient-Centered Plan for Near Universal Coverage and Permanent Fiscal Solvency. So let's talk about the latest strategy. Let me ask the audience here, do you think that there is any way that a Stop Donald Trump movement is going to work at this point, with Cruz spending time and Kasich saying, I won't campaign heavily in Indiana, it's yours, and Cruz saying to Kasich, go on and campaign a lot in Oregon and New Mexico in a attempt, of course, to keep Donald Trump from getting those 1,237 delegates. But what if he's 1,200 delegates or 1,175 delegates? What happens? Do you think that there will be total chaos? Why do you think it is the case that he is, at this point, the front runner and has been during all of this election cycle? We'll move into the Democratic side as well, but let's start with the Republican side today. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Kendra Smith is answering phones. Today's her last day. She's been a wonderful presence in our office and a great intern, so wish her well as she carries on. To your phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Avik Roy. Dave in Cedarburg, our first caller. Hi, Dave.
Yes, good afternoon. Just kind of had a question, comment for your speaker. You know, and I think when we're talking about the rise of Donald Trump and his popularity and then also Bernie Sanders, I think myself, I see it as kind of the flip side of the coin of the same populist discontent that there is in the society today, and especially with the economics. I think you're just finding different segments of the population just expressing it differently. Some, especially the younger people, with their support of Bernie Sanders, and then others with their support of Donald Trump. And I think even if you go back in recent history in our country, I think you're even seeing some cracks or fissures with this populist discontent, even with little things like, you know, the Occupy Wall Street movement and even the Tea Party movement. And I think that some of it is all somewhat of the same populist discontent that we have today, with just the way that people are feeling about our overall system, and maybe that, you know, the middle class and the working class not feeling like they're getting their dues, so to speak. And you know, and I'd like to hear what your speaker thinks about that.
Thanks, Dave. Avik Roy.
Yeah, so that echoes a lot of what we were talking about just before the break. I would say that there absolutely is a feeling out there that that, you know, if you look at polls, there's a lot of evidence of this. If you look at polls that ask the question, do you feel like if you work hard, you can have the success that you deserve for working hard? And if you look at that same question, and Gallup, I think, is one of the institutions that has asked this question longitudinally over many years, that there's been a significant decline in the number of people who feel that classic American sense of if you work hard, you can get ahead, that's as true today as it was, say, 10, 20, 30 years ago. So that's a problem. And, you know, I think that some of the people who were running for president, I think Marco Rubio was one of them, really tried to address those concerns, but he didn't make it through. And it seems like a lot of the people who feel most displaced because of those economic factors have been more attracted to candidates who've had a more angry message by tone, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump.
So let's look at the policy differences, because they are dramatic. They overlap a little bit, probably, when it comes to wealth inequality. But when you look at people who are attracted to Trump and people who are attracted to Bernie, I mean, Trump talking about the deportation of 11.5 million undocumented immigrants, and Bernie talking about wealth inequality, mostly, that's his message. There are many others. So one is a very left kind of message, and the other is, you know, it's not really conservative, but there is a let's get rid of these people because life will be better off if these people are back in Mexico or wherever they came from. Why would you go to Trump? Why would you go to Sanders?
Well, the Trump and Sanders messages are not that different on the economic nationalism agenda. So, for example, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are very skeptical of free trade. Both of them are skeptical of companies outsourcing jobs overseas, for example. Where they differ is on the immigration component, where Bernie Sanders is for legal status for illegal immigrants in the country today, whereas Trump wants to build the wall, et cetera. So that's the policy difference between Trump and Bernie, particularly to maybe a voter who feels more disaffected and isn't looking at their platforms with the finest tooth comb. Their worldviews are not super different, actually, again, particularly on the economic stuff. So it doesn't completely surprise me that you're seeing both of these guys, Bernie and Trump, are both really trying to speak to disaffected, displaced Americans, economically displaced Americans, who believe the system isn't working for them. The one difference is that the Trump voters are more open to the message of it's not just about free trade, it's about the free movement of people, that people coming into this country from elsewhere are a big part of why we who've been here and whose families have been here, whose fathers and grandfathers were here, that's the reason why we're suffering.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of, let's just talk about Sanders for a moment, because it looks as though he's not going to be the nominee, but his influence of the party, it's already had an influence on the campaign. We'll see how he influences their platform. This was in the week, this statement, when asked about Sanders being the stronger general election candidate, which polls show that he would be. Republicans haven't attacked him yet. This writer said if Sanders were the nominee, the GOP would paint him as an America-hating Trotskyite who admires the Castros and wants to raise everyone's taxes, put the government in charge of everything, and crippled the military, too dangerously radical to run their local food co-op, let alone the U.S. government. Is that the strategy that would be used, and would it really be very damning for him?
Well, I don't know what the strategy would be if he were the nominee. I mean, there's so many ways you could go about it, and it would depend, of course, who the Republican nominee was, too, in terms of where you would draw the contrast. I mean, I think from my standpoint, what you hear a lot of people who are of my worldview and mindset say is, you know, we actually agree with a lot of the problems that Bernie Sanders has identified about the way the economy is not working for average Americans. Mm. Where we really disagree is on the solution. So, for example, I personally agree very much with the concern that Bernie has that a few very large banks have disproportionate influence and that we're too dependent on those banks. If they were to fail, we'd have to bail them out again. That's a huge problem. We shouldn't have to do that. But Bernie Sanders' solution to that problem is to tax the banks, which... You know, if you're in favor of more taxes, well, okay, but that has really no impact on the actual behavior of banks and the things that banks are doing and the policies that are incentivizing banks to do certain things that are destabilizing the economy. And so, you know, where Bernie Sanders and a guy like me disagree is not on the concern about the big banks, it's what you do about it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. When I heard about this strategy that Cruz and Kasich have worked out, the first thing that occurred to me was, as I understand it, Kasich is mathematically unable to get the nod, and whereas Cruz could. And so when with the strategy, if it should work, and if they should deny Donald Trump the nomination, if Cruz gets the nomination, is there a real good likelihood that he will automatically or almost systematically select Kasich as his running mate, and maybe that's part of the deal that they've worked out?
You know, it's conceivable in the sense that I'm not privy to the private conversations that John Weaver and Jeff Rowe, the two campaign managers, had the other day where this deal got all worked out. However, I would say that I would be surprised if Ted Cruz picked John Kasich as his running mate. It just doesn't seem like, you know, all of Ted Cruz's messaging and his very brief but very prominent political career has all been about, you know, if you diverge from me on these very tiny points of difference, you're not a real Republican, you're not a real conservative. And John Kasich is someone who on policy diverges so much from conservative orthodoxy on so many issues that it would just kind of step all over Ted Cruz's brand to have someone like John Kasich be his running mate. Now, that doesn't mean it, you know, stranger things have happened in the world of running mates, so you can't ever rule it out. But it seems to me that Ted Cruz has a lot of other options that are more ideologically consistent. For example, he could pick Nikki Haley, the Indian-American female governor of South Carolina. That could be a very interesting choice that would be a conservative, but who would also kind of balance him out to some degree, not obviously being the governor of swing state, but in other ways. So we'll see. But I would say I put the odds below 30%, let's say, that Kasich will be the nominee if Trump, I mean, the vice presidential nominee if Cruz is at the top.
Hmm.
Well, what do you think is in it for Kasich then? Is it just the impulse to stop Trump?
No, I mean, I've been, you know, someone who's, whenever I get asked about this, I always say, like, Kasich has, just like you said, mathematically, he was eliminated a long time ago. Here's an amazing statistic about John Kasich. John Kasich is actually running in fourth place in the Republican race, even though there are only three candidates. Marco Rubio actually has more delegates than John Kasich, even though Marco Rubio dropped out of the race 5-6 weeks ago. So that shows you how poorly John Kasich is doing. And I think John Kasich has this idea that somehow we'll get to the convention if Trump doesn't get 1237 and the Republican National Committee delegates will vote for Kasich because they'll worry that both Cruz and Trump are unelectable. Now, right now, that can't happen because one of the RNC rules is that you have to have won the majority of delegates in 8 states in order to be considered for the nomination. Kasich has only done that in 1 state. Now, they could change those rules at the convention. Something could happen. But it seems to me that if Trump or Cruz can't cobble together a majority after multiple ballots, they're not going to turn to Kasich. They're going to turn to someone else. Maybe they turn to Paul Ryan despite all his denials. Maybe they turn to, you know, someone else who hasn't really thrown their hat in the ring. Who knows? But I just don't see John Kasich being the guy that people coalesce around. Because John Kasich, again, he's had so many deviations from conservative policy orthodoxy. And you want to talk about conservatives being mad that their views have been usurped. If Kasich is a nominee, they'll really feel that way.
Thanks, Scott, for your call. What about Donald Trump? Any inklings about who his VP might be?
Yeah, he's made some public statements about this, which are actually somewhat sensible from the Trump standard, which is that he said, look, I'm such an outsider. I want to have somebody as my running mate who's an insider, who really gets how Washington works, and that way can kind of help me interact with the rest of the government. One possibility there could be Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama, who's been a prominent supporter of Trump because they share the same views on immigration policy. One of Jeff Sessions' staffers actually left the senator's office to become Donald Trump's policy director.
Hmm.
So they have close ties, and that could be one obvious possibility for Donald Trump, but we'll just have to see. I mean, you know, you never know with him. He has lots of interesting ideas.
You never know with him. How true. Jonathan in Appleton, hi.
Good afternoon. You've answered my A question. I'm going to go to the B question, if you don't mind. What do you make out of somebody challenging Speaker Paul Ryan's seat here in Wisconsin and Debbie Wasserman Schultz down there in Florida? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so with Paul Ryan, I mean, I haven't looked at polls recently in his district, but Paul Ryan, historically speaking, first of all, it's incredibly difficult to defeat the Speaker of the House in a general election for his house seat. That almost never happens because if you're in that district and you're an apolitical voter, which, of course, few people are in Wisconsin anymore, but to the degree that those voters exist, they look at it like, hey, we've got the Speaker of the House in this district. Why would we give that up? That's somebody who can do a lot for us. In terms of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, it may be a different story because she's been more controversial within Democratic ranks. There was the whole situation, obviously, a couple of months ago when, as DNC chairman, she suspended Bernie Sanders' campaign's access to important DNC voter data files, and there may be some hard feelings around that. So there you might see, you know, a different situation. But I'd say that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, from basically my understanding, is that she's not as universally popular in the Democratic Party, whereas Paul Ryan is quite popular among Republicans.
We go to Dorothea in Hill Point. Hi, Dorothea.
Hi. I basically more have a statement than a question. But the polls, I just wonder where they're getting these polls of the dislike for Donald Trump. Because I for one, have never taken any kind of poll. And people in my area in Wisconsin are for Trump. And I guess I'm definitely for Trump, or I'm always been Republican, but I don't know. I just don't really believe that he has that high a dislike across the nation. I mean, is that what those polls are nationwide?
Yes, they are.
Of his dislike. And
yeah.
It's hard for me to believe because if you even follow Twitter, you know, they call it the Trump train, and it just seems like a lot of people are on board that train,
yeah,
if you will.
There's no doubt about that. Why do you like him, Dorothea?
Because I've always liked people that I speak my mind, and I appreciate people that just say it like it is. Yes, I guess he isn't necessarily politically correct, but I'm not either. You know, I say Merry Christmas and God bless, and, you know, but I also like that he says no one will be sick and dying on the street, which now is happening all across our nation. And I just think it's horrific that we're bringing all these people in from other countries and we have people dying on the street, you know, or sitting on welfare, and then they bring these people in from Islam or wherever they're coming from and slapping them immediately on welfare, and we're all paying the buck. So I guess that's what I'm discontented about, the whole thing.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dorothea. Avicroy?
Yeah, well, I think that was a really beautiful articulation of Trump's appeal. And, you know, what I would say about why, you know, she asked the question of, these polls don't make sense to me because based on my experience, there are a lot of Trump supporters out there. And I think what's being illustrated by that observation is that Trump's appeal is appealing. He has particular appeal in particular parts of the country and particular regions, regions of the country, and also areas that are perhaps a little bit more manufacturing oriented, where there's more of that blue collar displacement that we were talking about. So if you're in one of those communities that's been hard hit by various economic factors for the last 10, 20 years, probably a lot of people, you know, much more than 30, 40%, maybe 70, 80, 90%, are feeling like Trump is the guy. And in maybe more metropolitan areas, that's less the case. So that's, I think, part of what we're seeing there.
Let's go to John in Milwaukee. Hi. Whoa. John, are you there?
Hi.
Your phone. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Your guest, I think, would probably know Congressman Alan Grayson from Florida, Democrat,
sure.
Who has confronted Bernanke and the Federal Reserve bankers, Goldman Sachs people, et cetera, and tried to figure out where they dispensed the government loans to them of $1.5 trillion. And he laughed at their answers. Do you think Alan Grayson might be a good VP candidate for Bernie Sanders?
Well, I don't have a lot of insight into Bernie's thinking about who he'd want as a VP, but certainly Representative Grayson is someone who has been articulating some of the same themes. And again, it goes to something I said earlier. I've been an outspoken critic of Federal Reserve policy. I think one of the real underestimated problems that we've had over the last 8 years and longer is that the Federal Reserve, because of what they've done to keep interest rates artificially low, that's been incredibly enriching to the top 1%, because if you own a lot of real estate, the value of real estate is going up because demand for real estate has been artificially inflated by the Federal Reserve. If you own a lot of stocks, if you own a lot of securities, if you're an investor, if you're a hedge fund manager, you're making enormous amounts of money thanks to the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve is artificially driving up the value of stock prices. So the Obama economy has been really great for the really rich. It has not been great for everyone else. And again, not only is that a part of what Bernie's appeal is, but it's part of what Trump's appeal is too.
Thanks, John, for your call. This is All Things Political. You're listening to on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is Avik Roy, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and we're welcoming your phone calls. There are other ways to reach us, too. We have a line open if you would like to call right now, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We'd love to read your messages on Facebook, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. If you like us, you'll know about upcoming shows as well. Good way to keep informed of what we'll have on the air. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email that has come in, Avik. My question is regarding the unique way in which Bernie Sanders is funding his campaign in this post-Citizens United world. I find the strategy to be revolutionary as a means of removing the influence of money in politics. If Bernie is successful, it may change the dynamic so candidates focus more on voters instead of donors.
Well, you know, this is one of the things that I think is extremely interesting that hasn't actually gotten a lot of the right kind of commentary from the left. So when Citizens United, that Supreme Court case, came down, the consensus of the left then and now from Bernie and President Obama and everyone else is, well, this is going to mean there's going to be more big money in politics. And those of us who were on the other side of that debate who believe that the First Amendment requires Congress to not regulate political speech and donations to politicians argue the opposite, that in fact, when you get rid of the regulations, what's going to happen is it's going to open up the system so that more people can raise money from the whole country rather than having to have these gigantic fundraising apparatuses in the Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush model. And that's exactly what we've seen. Bernie Sanders has raised an enormous amount of money from small donors. Ted Cruz has done the same on the right, by the way. They have both raised enormous amounts of money, $10, $20, $50 at a time. And this is a direct result of the deregulation of political speech through the Citizens United case and unrelated case law.
Yeah. Let's go to Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
I'm stunned what your guest just said. I'm absolutely stunned. He just said that big money in our system makes us more democratic. That is totally, totally against everything I've been taught as a child.
Is that what you said, Avik?
No, that's not what I said. I said the opposite. The big money has always been there. It's the small money that now has the opportunity to express itself thanks to some of these decisions.
Can I finish my statement?
Yeah, go ahead, Ray.
All right. I just interpreted it as you just said, it's fine.
Well, he didn't say that. So,
that's how I'm hearing it in my mind. But what I want to get at is Hillary Clinton's criticism of Bernie Sanders when Bernie says he wants to break up the big banks. It's like somebody admitting this system has cancer, and the cancer is the big money, not small donors donating. Millions of small donors donating and winding up with the large. It's the big banks. And all Hillary can say about Bernie is he doesn't know what to do. Well, first you have to admit you have cancer. Then the doctors can try different treatments. And all Bernie is pointing out is this system is full of cancer, and that cancer is also in the Democratic Party. And it's just as strong in the Democrats as it is in the Republicans. Do you remember Barack Obama in 2007? Coming to Wisconsin and telling union people in Wisconsin, if your union rights are ever threatened, I will be here in an instant. Where was he the last, 7 years?
All right, Ray. Thank you. Avik Roy.
Yeah, so again, I would just simply say that the campaign finance system, broadly speaking, that we have in this country began in the mid-70s in the wake of the Watergate scandal, when we started to regulate how people could donate to campaigns. And the unintended those rules, those laws were well intended. The idea was let's limit the influence of big money on campaigns. What ended up happening was the unintended consequence was the opposite of that, which was to say because the way you could raise money was so heavily regulated, you could only get $2,700 from each person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What ended up happening was unless you had a gigantic fundraising operation that could get these chunks of money from any one individual, you couldn't actually be competitive in presidential campaigns or senatorial campaigns. That's why so many of the people who run for office now are independently wealthy. The percentage of senators and congressmen who are millionaires has skyrocketed in the last several decades because the only people who can afford to run for president are either people who are like Hillary Clinton, who are incredibly plugged in with corporate donors, or billionaires and multimillionaires. So the Bernie Sanders model, which is a new model that comes from changes to campaign finance law over the last several years, is a very salutary development. And I completely agree. Look, as I said earlier in the hour, I said, look, we've got to do something to reform the big banks, and Hillary Clinton is not going to be the person who does that. She's got the ear of the big banks. But I just wish that Bernie would do more to develop his actual plan to do something about it.
Thanks, Ray. Maddie in Oneida. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to say that I wish that every American could see the film called Food, Inc. It is available on Netflix. Our American people, especially the farmers, are losing their American civil rights, American freedom of speech, freedom of to do business. And, they're being totally controlled by Monsanto, and both the Democrats and the Republicans have... And right up to Barack Obama, they put them in charge, making decisions. And like I say, I have voted Democrat all my life, but if it's between Hillary and Trump, I'm going to roll the dice and vote for Trump.
You know, one of the things that that we've had this recurring theme this hour about people being very concerned about the influence of large corporations and large institutions in politics, and it must be said that there is a profoundly unfair and disproportionate influence of big corporations in politics. And there are a couple of things to say about that. One is that the more the government is involved in regulating a sector of the economy, the more big business has an incentive to lobby Congress and regulators to shape those rules in their favor. The less the government's involved in regulating the economy, the more this is up to entrepreneurs and competition to fight it out on a level playing field. So that's a big part of the problem, is the more the government regulates things, the more obscure regulations become captured by the regulated entities like banks, like Monsanto, like these other big corporations. So that's a big part of what we have to change.
Thanks, Maddie. Bruce on Facebook asks, do you think, Avik, that the large number of candidates on the GOP side allowed Trump to get the lead, even though he didn't win the majority of the Republican votes in most states?
Definitely. The fact that it was a fragmented field played very much in Trump's hands, because if he's got this one-third of the electorate that's behind him, and the two-thirds that are more than kind of conventional Republicans and conventional conservatives are split, that's what gave him the initial traction in the initial states. And again, it should be said again, that the reason why there were 16 candidates is because the campaign finance system has been deregulated in such a way that more and more candidates could find financial support and run. It used to be only a couple of people could create the financial infrastructure to run for president. Now a lot of people can, and a lot of people have.
Marilyn in Cleveland. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if there might not be a backlash against the efforts of the Republican Party establishment to stifle Trump, if that might not make people resent that and vote more for Trump. And on the other side of the aisle, I wonder if that might not be true, because the Democratic establishment has made it clear they want Hillary. I have heard some supporters of Sanders saying they will not vote for Hillary. So could there be a backlash on both sides?
Yeah, you know, there absolutely will be, no matter who's the nominee. You know, I think what you could say is that the odds are pretty high that whoever ends up winning this election in 2016 is a one-term president, because he'll have gained election with a lot of people in their own party and a lot of people in the other party really disliking them.
Well, that's kind of sad, isn't it?
It is, really. But, you know, I mean, if you look at the world today, I don't know how you can get to any other conclusion.
Yeah.
I hope I'm wrong, but that seems to be where we're headed.
Thanks, Marilyn. Jim in Madison, hi.
Hi. They're saying that Trump has been successful so far because people are fed up. And what I'm wondering, if that's the case, then let's see how many incumbents get reelected where the incumbents got the people fed up in the first place.
You know, it's a great point. I mean, it's funny how the people who've been in charge all this time aren't really being held accountable, and it's being kind of taken out on this presidential race. You know, and I don't really have a good answer for you as to why that's the case, but that is clearly where people are taking out their frustrations.
Mm. What a year this one is, when it goes on, as we'll learn. 18 months we've been at this, and we're not done yet. 18 months, Avik.
Yeah,
whoa.
That's true.
Yeah.
And that's not going to be too long when we start talking about the next one, right?
No, we need a break for a little while. Well, thank you. We hope we can join you again, or have you join us again, as we get a little bit closer.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks. Avik Roy, our guest this hour, he's been with us many times before. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He has advised a number of Republicans, Florida Senator Marco Rubio. He was a senior advisor to former Texas Governor Rick Perry, and he served as healthcare policy advisor to Mitt Romney. We've had him on the show several times talking about healthcare. He's the principal author of The Apothecary, which is the Forbes blog on healthcare policy and entitlements. And he's the author of Transcending Obamacare, a patient-centered plan for near universal coverage and permanent fiscal solvency, written a couple of years ago. Thanks very much to KP Whaley for producing the program, and thanks to the very capable Kendra Smith, who has been our intern. Today's her last day, so wish her well. She's been great. She did all our on-air production. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. You know, it's been 18 months of campaigning, but then it's going to be 73 days to hand over control of the entire federal government, and we need to be better prepared. That's hour two.